Well, thanks very much. It's a real honor and a pleasure to be here this morning. And I'd like to thank, obviously, EuroPARC Federation, but also the Parc du Jura. It's lovely to be in our neighborhood here in this beautiful, beautiful rolling hills of the Jura. And such a pleasure to have the opportunity to address this very, very important audience. You are the leaders of conservation and of the park movement for Europe, and you are a very strong voice. When you speak, you are heard. And certainly from IUCN's perspective, your voice matters and matters greatly. Today, I'm going to essentially talk about sort of five basic messages. It's simple stuff with huge implications. And the first message is really just that, and I carry that message from Hawaii. We just had our large Congress, and maybe some of you were there, or maybe you had colleagues who were there, and thank you to those of you who came or who had colleagues to come. We had over 10,000 people. And one clear message that we put forward is the planet is at the crossroads. We are standing at this crossroads, and what we do or we don't do in our generation, in our time, will forever determine the future of this planet. This is an awesome and a frightening, but a massive responsibility that each one of us carry. You as well as us, as well as every elected politician. Some know about it, some don't. Our job is to make them hear and understand. And I think we're trying to do that. E.O. Wilson was with us and he spoke about the fact that unless we take drastic action, half of the species described today will be gone by the end of this century. Now that is an unimaginable future, a future that cannot be. But today we know that we're losing species about 1,000 times the natural extinction rate, with 80% of terrestrial land species losses being driven by agriculture. But last I checked, we all eat. And so, you know, there is a dimension there to be dealt with that we have to talk about. And we also know that we only have about 15% of we've only managed to protect about terrestrial 15% and 4% of the ocean. And let's press the pause button for a moment there, because we can celebrate the 15 or even the Aichi target of 10% of marine, 17 of terrestrial, but pause. What does that mean? So the other 85% is unsustainable? So that's okay? It's not okay. And that's why it matters what we do in parks and what we do outside parks. The question just before directed at Carlos is hugely important, because the sustainability cannot be these isolated islands. These islands have to be the beacon of hope for the whole integrated planet. So the first message is we are at the crossroads. In this room, we're preaching to the converted. We have taken the right road, but we have not boomed that message out sufficiently to those who take decisions, and we need to do more of that. But thankfully, I will say, the world has woken up, and that will be my second message, that there is a greater degree and a growing awareness around the imperative of nature conservation, not just for the beauty of nature, which matters greatly, not just for the awe-inspiring nature, which is hugely important, not just for the rights of species, which we take for granted, but for our very survival. We are, in a way, living in an existential moment, a moment where climate change, species loss, we're pushing against the very planetary boundaries, phosphorus, nitrogen, ozone, by the way, is one of our success stories. And just last week, this week, in Kigali, a deal was struck on ozone-depleting substances. Meanwhile, on all of the other planetary boundaries, especially biodiversity, we're pushing against that with an extraordinary speed. So the good thing is that there is an awakening around this. 2015, we saw the Paris Agreement, we saw the Sustainable Development Goals, we saw the Sendai Agreement, a lot of global agreements that came to the fore and showed that multilateralism can work and that there is an understanding that unless we take action in our generation, it will be too late. And protected areas and ecosystems are central to this awakening. I put it to you that in a sense, you have been the stewards of this message for decades, and we saw in Carlos's presentation how long the story around protected areas have been around and how long this community have carried this message. and protected areas are absolutely key to the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals. Now, many of us will remember that the Millennium Development Goals, oh, well, that was not for Europe, right? That was for these other parts. Well, I've got news for you. Sustainable Development Goals, you know this, all of you, is for everyone. And we each need to hold ourselves, our families, our communities, our local communities, our countries, and our European Union to account for living up to what they signed up to in Sustainable Development Goals. And there, the targets that are there, both in terrestrial and in marine, SDGs 14 and 15, and across the spread, climate change, etc., matter. And the protected area story on both 14 and 15 are critical. But I just want to read to you what Goal 15, which speaks to terrestrial life on land. It says, protect, restore, and promote sustainable use of terrestrial ecosystem, sustainable managed forest, combat desertification, and halt and reverse land degradation and halt biodiversity loss. And there are specific targets, and clearly protected areas have a huge role to play here. And of course, in the Paris Agreement, we had all of this underpinned by the importance of management of protected areas, our oceans, as well as our terrestrial land. But we also know that during this decade, we saw the needle shift so that more than 50% of this Earth group population live in cities. And people are getting more and more divorced from the reality of nature, from understanding that awe of the beautiful sunrise, from having an experience standing holding your mother and father's hand and seeing some mighty birds swoop down on you and finding that connection with nature that you find often as a young child. More and more kids are growing up in inner cities. So the reality of this is that the challenge is becoming harder and harder. This community knows this very well, but it's a how to make that connect. That's why in Hawaii, one of the emphases we put was on the youth. And it can't be the older, grayer folks preaching at the young ones that they gotta go out and enjoy nature. It's gonna be the other way around. They will tell us if we allow them a voice. And I know inside the European Park community, many of the organizations are in fact creating youth programs when it's not that they're being mentored by the older folks, but when they are given the right to lead. That matters. And that was a voice that we heard very clearly in Hawaii. Young people will take a role, but give us a chance. We think differently than you, they will tell us. We're born, we're grown and up in a different generation, and our words, our way of connecting will matter. And that's an important thing to find out how to make happen. But at the same time, as we are seeing urban sprawl happen, this community also has a voice. Atlanta, Barcelona. One city is 10 times bigger than the other, but they have the same amount of people in it. Barcelona is highly dense, Atlanta is a sprawl. The story is about how we develop and how we use that terrestrial land. It is scarce and unique. And this community has a story to talk about when we see development, even outside the protected areas. So we know, my third message therefore is, that protected areas will only remain on this agenda if they're able to contribute to the needs of the people who live in and of and around them by 2050. Otherwise, it will become, as someone just said in the question, sort of islands of little museums of what once was. Natural history museums, living natural history museums, God forbid. So, how then to make that relevance, to make that connect? To make it connected to my health, my food, my well-being, my physical understanding of how the world works, to the ecosystem services that we rely on. Each of these protected areas provides those services, but are they communicating it adequately across the globe? I say no. Are we quantifying the ecosystem services that politicians don't understand? They just see the budget on the Ministry of Environment, PA. No, but this is where the pollinators come in. This is where the water storage often happens. This is where productivity comes in. Lots of things happen. This is where health is restored, human health as well as animal health. So there's a lot that these services are provided, but we don't know how to communicate it. This is an important story. Because unless we realize and speak to these co-benefits, unless we understand the imperative of protecting, unless we have those messages come out, frankly, we are not winning this story, this I won't say battle, but we're not winning these arguments, which we need to win, not just for the parks community, but for the planet, because we are at that crossroads. So that would be my third message, remain relevant to the current conversation. And that conversation is about urban development. That conversation is about health. That conversation is about food. That conversation is about climate change. Make your relevance, make our relevance inside these communities. That's how this conversation is born. And so it is about finding balance between five areas for protected areas. One, protected areas have to be in the right places. And yes, there are historical reasons why at times protected areas were put one in place of the other, and we get that for game, for royalty in my country, for example, or what have you. But we also need to make sure that actually it overlaps with biodiversity imperatives. Actually it overlaps with ecosystem services. And there we're very proud in Hawaii to have rolled out the key biodiversity areas that will map this out as a new standard. The second point that we need to, these five areas of critical relevance for protected areas, is that we have to have good and effective management of these areas. Now in Europe, the governance and management is probably much stronger than in many other parts of the world where we work as IUCN. But nevertheless, we just heard now from Carlos that we have paper parks even in this neighborhood. And so that's why we're so proud at IUCN of the green list that we rolled out. The green list sort of tries to create a race to the top. Who wants to get on the green list? Get that badge, that gold star, beyond Natura 2000, but essentially a global recognition that the management and the protection here meets that gold standard. And we think that this green list is filling the gap, and we're very proud that there are already 8 protected areas in Europe that are green listed. And we're delighted that the European Commission will be investigating how the green list can be applied to the Natura 2000 network. Thirdly, they have to be inclusive. I spoke about that. Women, young people, a marginalized group for our community is often indigenous people. But people who live in, of, and with these areas need to feel that they belong and they have a say in the governance as well as in the use. That will obviously strengthen the story, and that's something that we are working very much on. There were a number of resolutions at Hawaii and before, and of course today we're standing here in this beautiful park, Jumawadwa, where we exactly see that the youth story and the living with and working with the community is critical to the very success. And fourthly, we have to have parks that have sustainable financing. We need to understand the returns. I mentioned that before, but you know, in, for example, one study shows us that it was a Finnish study, for €1 invested in parks, you get a €10 return. Now, that's really important, but are we communicating that well enough? And my story around ecosystem services and other benefits. Now, at the global level at the IUCN, we work very much with parks, with communities, to help optimize those returns, to help communities understand the imperative of protection for the future of the planet and for the well-being of its biodiversity and its people. And the last point in these five must-haves for parks would be they have to be connected. The story about little islands that just sit is obviously not a story for success. It's not, so we need to think about those connectivities, be it by species, be it by relevance, be it by migration, migratory bird, flyways, etc. These things we need to find that they cannot, we need to understand they cannot exist without the broader network of which you are, nor can they exist without connecting to those communities, to the agriculturalists, to the climate change story, etc. So the imperative of integration is important. And so these were sort of the five must-haves that I wanted to pass to you in my third message. My fourth message is, well, the problems that we're facing in nature do require global responses. We can't resolve this on a local level. The local action is imperative. We have to link up. If we don't link up, what we will be doing will be good, but not good enough. That's why the Europark community is so important, because you are linking up. That's why IUCN tries to be that global platform for linking up. In Europe, you have, and we saw some numbers from Carlos as well, 53% of all protected areas in the world. You have over 115 sites, as I last saw. So this is a vast number. So you are a leader. And we saw, going back to the early part, well, even to the times of kings and queens in the 16th, 17th, and way before in some countries, century. But the real movement, obviously, starting with the beginning of the 1900s and taking off after the Second World War in a big way. But the problems that we're facing are global in nature. Species loss due to climate change, all land use practices, all land use changes, all the kind of legal instruments that we have, all the kind of protection that we accept, are global issues to be handled and had at a global conversation as well as a local conversation. That's the story that we try to communicate in IUCN, that we need to be that big tent where this community can come in and power up. That's what we try to do in Hawaii as well. So I'm really inspired and delighted that the Europark Federation is reaching out. You have a lot of knowledge, a lot of insight, a lot of experience, and you're reaching out, for example, to the Asia Park Protected Areas Partnership. We thank you for that. You bring your knowledge and you're twinning with those folks, and this is a really good way of building strength and muscle in another region that is struggling against rapid, or with, living with rapid industrialization and population growth. So this is part of, you have sort of reached out on a global scale from the European perspective, which we really appreciate. And in a way, you know, IUCN, as I said, we try to be that big tent. For 70 years, we've been around, established in 1948, at a time when you did not find environmental movements, when you found a few parks associations, a few bird watchers, but you didn't find NGOs and communities and ministers of environment and convention. But we try to be that big tent where everybody meets. And we think, with Hawaii behind us, and with the kind of mood that we're seeing on the environmental platform, and let me write that environmental platform huge, because it includes the climate story, it includes the pollution story, it includes biodiversity story, it includes the very path that we're going to take as a planet. That story is being written now. And as I said, what we do or don't do will forever determine the future of this planet. So that responsibility that we hold is frightening. But it is also one that should give us incredible courage and pride, pride in what we're doing. And that is why the European park story is so important. That is why it is now time to tell that story. In a way, it's sort of a best kept secret. And you need to be inside the community to know how powerful that story is. But that story is amazing. And it is one that reverberates. When we tell that story in Asia, it reverberates. So what I would like to leave you with is sort of essentially unveiling that best secret, that European strength that you have, that how you connect with your communities in your policy making as well as in the broader global setting. We've discovered Europe's best-kept secret. The challenge now is to bring that secret to bear for the entire global community. So as we take the right road on these crossroads, that story will be told and we will reverberate. Thank you very much.
Which is awesome, but frightening at the same time. Should the whole world be a park?
Well, what defines a park? Let's have a conversation. Look, what defines a park in a way is a definition. You know, so Connor's asking, is it out of date? Of course it's not out of date. He's absolutely right in his response. But when Ian Wilson says nature needs half, okay, he says it for us to understand that no, you may not pave over, extract, pollute the other half. You need to think about the whole, how we manage that in a sustainable way. Now, obviously, as I said, you know, we still have 1.3 billion people living in extreme poverty. We still have 800 million people who are perennially malnourished. And we still need, they have every right to live like you and I. And we will all need to eat, last I checked. And so what we need to do is to think about the paths that we take. And we can't just, we're too many people on this good planet to extract and pollute our way to wealth. It doesn't work anymore. It maybe did, maybe it didn't, but you know, you could sort of think of other places as your garbage lots. You can't do that anymore. This, we're living in an interconnected world, and that would be my response. Mm.
Thank you very much. Your turn now. Who wants to address the question to Inger Andersen?
Okay. Two questions. One, will you tell the 2.1 people that you talked about a few minutes ago that haven't enough food that the birds are more important than you people? And two, will you be able to see the corporate world with the greed they have allowing food, allowing the management of food in a biodiversity way, in an eco-friendly way? Because I can't see that. We suffer that in Ireland. The corporate world wants the profit, and they want a cheap product, and they don't care. So tell me a way that we can make those people care.
So I will never tell a starving family not to kill that bird. I will never do that, and I'm sorry for saying that, but you would never do that too if your children were starving. So we must understand that poverty has to be a priority for those who live in poverty and for those who don't. And that's the story of the Sustainable Development Goals. We are all in this basket together. And so, but we have also learned that poverty can be a huge driver of environmental degradation. Poverty is because simply you are living on the edge of your very existence and you have to cut that last tree to make charcoal, or whatever it is that you have to do. So therefore, the story about sustainable development, finding a path that will allow you not just to live tomorrow after you cut the tree and stole the charcoal, but the day after and the day after, and your children too. So this is about working with communities in a bigger picture to help them create sustainability around their existence. That would be, and it's not easy, and there's not a sort of one-shot answer, and poorer communities, it takes time to do that, but unless we as environmentalists and conservationists understand that, I don't think we will have success. So the story of environmentalism and development being an opposite side of the coin, I don't buy that for 1 minute. This is totally connected. And the more I work in poorer communities, the more I see that, you know, societies actually recall and remember what life was like before degradation happened in the Sahel, what it was like before the polluting factory came in and destroyed our health, etc. On your second point, I think that what we are seeing is there are still those who will think short-term, companies now I'm talking about, who will think that, yeah, the next quarter's profit margin, the higher I can drive it, the better for my shareholders. But there are also those who are beginning to understand that this is a question for the very survival of those companies. If you want to secure your supply chain and you are a fishing company, you would be wise not to fish the seas empty, because a quarter after you fish the seas empty, your shareholders go bust. I'm making an extreme case. The story here is that the long-termism for many of those industries and the companies that are involved in production that is linked to land and sea are understanding that investing in sustainability has to be part and parcel of the solution. Now, domestic legislation helps, because you can also take those companies to court if they do things that are not there. Anti-corruption helps, good governance helps, all of these things, and free media helps. So let us understand that all of these elements that are part and parcel of driving a movement become part of the rights of communities and therefore the very sustainability. We're not there yet, because you're right, but I'm seeing more and more where global vigilance, local law enforcement, as well as good corporate leadership can actually deliver some of the sustainable results that we want to see. And that's what we need to amplify as a movement, that that's the way forward, I would say.
Thank you very much. We have one question here somewhere.
Thank you. One of the key messages you gave us was the need for national parks and protected areas to take the message beyond our boundaries. And that was a key theme of the previous presentation. But one of the things worrying me, looking at the growth in the number and area of protected areas across Europe, my experience would be that that hasn't been followed by a similar increase in resources for protected area management. And are we in danger, therefore, of struggling more and more to do the day job, and protected areas looking increasingly inwards rather than taking the innovation and the test bed outwards? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you are so much more qualified than I to answer that question, but if you want my two cents, here's what I would say. I would say that we have seen also the expansion of the geopark movement, other elements that has allowed for a more dynamic use of what nevertheless on a sustainable footing involving local communities. I'm just really pleased with the geopark movement because I see that as being part and parcel of a trajectory of use. I think that we probably, if we want to think of like E.O. Wilson, nature needs half, we're not going to find that half being managed in the government budget. Not that I think we'll get to half, but I will keep echoing the idea of thinking about the totality of this planet being sustainably managed. Therefore, it comes back to the previous question. What is the responsibility of the users of land, the big tea plantations, the big, you know, let alone palm oil? What's the responsibility of those who use land in certain ways to ensure better use and sustainability? It's a conversation that is beginning to happen at the global level, in part due to pressure. But I think we have to realize that as we work to expand the system, private landowners have a role, indigenous people, maybe not so much in Europe, but nevertheless, have a role, users have a role in running and saying and in managing and in financing, but also reaping the benefits from these areas. But you're so much more competent than I to speak on this. This would be my two cents. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this last question that's concluding our presentation morning.